This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, after what turned out to be a walk in the park against Newcastle, Manchester City are heading to Wembley, or Etihad South, if you prefer, for a sixth consecutive FA Cup semi-final. So what does that record say about Pep Guardiola's City? How good was City's performance against Newcastle? Did Mateo Kovacic and Stefan Ortega do enough to force their way into the first choice 11? And how are City shaping up ahead of the running? We'll be answering all of those questions and many more on today's Blue Moon podcast. And later in the show, we also have the second part of our interview with former City chairman David Bernstein. I'm Dan Burke, standing in for David Mooney this week. And joining me is City fan Kieran Clark.
You all right?
And The Athletic's Mark Critchley.
How are we doing? You all right?
Not bad, Mark. How are you? How's international breaks treated in your line of work? Is it a bit of a relief for you, or are you sort of scrabbling around for stuff to do?
You know what? In my old job at The Independent, I would be scrabbling around for stuff to do because it was much more day in, day out on the hamster wheel of press conferences, matches, etc., etc. What's next? But no, I'm given a bit more leeway to write longer term things at The Athletic, as I'm sure everyone's aware, having read the 8,000 words of stuff that we produce on a daily basis or whatever. So yeah, there's a little bit more time. It's a little bit more relaxed. It's like one big international break rather than just 2 weeks at a time.
You're having a DOS, is what you're saying, basically?
That basically is what I'm saying, yes.
And Casey, all good with you?
Yeah, sound. International break just means, you know, more family stuff, really, that you don't get an opportunity to do. So I think I'm spending Saturday doing Bluey stuff.
I don't know what that is. I'm not going to ask either.
It's
Cartoon Dog. How do you not know what Bluey is? Watch it, mate.
Is that the same as Blue's Clues?
No. It's much better than that.
Okay,
no.
Fair enough.
It's definitely watchable as an adult.
All right, well, there's a little tip for the listeners there. I've got an interesting question to begin with for both of you today. I'm sure you both saw that clip of Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp causing a bit of a stir after their defeat at Old Trafford on Sunday when he said to a Danish journalist, "You are obviously not in great shape." That was after his side's lack of intensity had been questioned. So we'll let the listeners decide what Klopp meant by that. But what I want to know is, what is the most hurtful insult you have ever received? KC, I get the impression that you probably received a lot of insults in your life, but they kind of wore off a duck's back to you.
Yeah, most of the time they are, yeah. I was going to say, you've probably heard a lot worse when we've been out on the lash together about me. But the immediate thing that sprang to mind when you suggested this was, again, my daughter loves sitting on my belly when we're watching telly. So I lie on the couch and she sits on my belly. And the other day she just said, "Daddy, you're like a cuddly hippo," which, that kind of hurt a little bit.
That's quite a nice one.
Yeah, it's quite a nice one, but it's basically, "Daddy, you're big and fat," basically, is what she's saying there in not so many words.
Well, I was expecting a lot worse to come out of your mouth than that, to be honest with you. I was expecting a bit X-rated.
To be honest with you, most of the times when I'm out on the lash and hear all sorts of stuff, I forget them by the morning.
Yeah,
so
fair
I'm
enough.
Not too worried, yeah.
Mark, any particularly cutting ones that have stayed with you over the years?
Like KC there, I've kind of repressed them all over the years, I reckon. People won't know this listening to the podcast, but I have red hair. So that is obviously just, you know, ginger pubes, Ranga, short for Rangatan, all that. You know, once you absorb all that in your youth, you become kind of Teflon to it. But now I remember once I was walking into school and I was like year seven, and there was like a gang of like year 11s looking out the window on like the first floor of the building. And they were shouting at me and they shouted, mate, your hair's on fire. And I thought, oh, this is hilarious. So I like kind of ironically pretended to like pat my hair out as though I was actually on fire. And then this gang of year 11s all just burst out laughing, saying, "Oh, he actually thinks his hair's on fire." So irony was lost on a lot of people.
I thought the twist there was going to be that your hair was on fire.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for.
That would be a better story. That would be a better story, but no, it wasn't. But I got, Chesney as well. I got Chesney.
Oh, that's a bad one, yeah.
I had to just, kind of at school where you kind of just have to put up with it, but then also give a bit back and then eventually it'll stop, that sort of thing. I wasn't too much of a fan of the Chesney one, but But yeah, that finally petered out after about 18 months. So.
Yeah. One that I had that always stayed with me, I was on a night out in Newcastle once and a Geordie told me that I had no edge. And the reason that I had no edge apparently was because I was wearing a coat in December on a night out, which I just found that like subtly very cutting. Like, you know me, KC, I've got edge, haven't I?
You've got softer edges, let's say.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a bit of edge, yeah. But yeah, wearing a coat in December in Newcastle is fine, yeah. I think. But to be fair, like, I've been out in Newcastle in the winter, and the girls that go out there with, like, short skirts and they end up with blue legs, it's that cold, and it's just like, you know, fair play to them. They're very hardy up there.
Well, we'll talk about Newcastle's edge or lack of it shortly. That's a nice little segue, isn't it? But as always, this episode of the Blooming Podcast is sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. The season is entering the business end and Green King Sport venues are showing every single televised fixture over the 2023-24 season. And with more than 900 sports pubs across the UK, it doesn't matter where you're based, you can catch every single minute of the action. Football is best enjoyed with your mates, so if you're not at the ground this month, get a text in the group chat and head to your local Green King Sports venue to catch the game. Don't forget to download the Green King Sport app to enjoy exclusive competitions and discounts whenever there's a match on. Right, let's get into a review of the 2-0 win over Newcastle at the weekend then. I want to start by talking about City's FA Cup record. I used the words Etihad South to describe Wembley in the intro there. Apparently, I learned this weekend that Liverpool fans also call it Anfield South. We're not having that, are we, Casey?
Well, we've, you know, even if we came up with it first, we've definitely copied them there, haven't we? You know, because they invented everything in Liverpool, haven't they?
Not like them to make something about themselves either, is it?
To be honest, I've not heard people say Etihad South either. How long have you been saying that, Dan?
That's been going for a while, I think, yeah.
Has it?
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I'm just got my head up my ass. Yeah. Wembley is the stadium that I've been to most, aside from the Etihad, actually, now that I think about it. So, even saying the Etihad still feels weird to me. I still want to call it Eastlands. It's just, we are there a lot, aren't we? And I suppose, yeah, you just got to be grateful that we're there all the time, really. I'm a bit worried about what would happen if we do end up there. If it does end up that we don't go as often, because it did used to be a right treat, didn't it, when we first started going down. Like, you know, thinking about the United semi in 2011 and stuff like that, it felt like an adventure. But nowadays, when you go down and you're on the coach, although it is still very good, it doesn't feel, you know, quite the same, does it?
Well, don't worry. Once Sir Jim Ratcliffe builds his Wembley of the North, then we won't have that far to travel, will we, really? So it won't be too bad. I mean, the stats don't lie about City's trips to Wembley. They've now been to Wembley at least once in every calendar year since 2010. And under Guardiola, it's a record 6th FA Cup semi-final. Mark, what do you think that record says about him, and how does his approach to domestic cups compare to his managerial peers, do you think?
I think it says everything that we've known for a while, which is that he takes the domestic cups more seriously than perhaps people expected when he first arrived, but consistently seriously over the years that he's been here as well. I think it's kind of a product of, you know, we always say he likes smaller squads and he likes to rotate during a league season anyway, game to game, right? And so that necessarily means that a lot of the same players are going to be used in the domestic cup ties. And look, I think as long as it maintains this kind of the rhythm that he wants and you know, the fitness levels and balances them across the squad, then he's always been happy to do it. And it also speaks to just the fact that it's, especially the FA Cup, right? And obviously the Carabao finals in February decided a bit earlier, but if you're having consistent success in the FA Cup, while still challenging for Premier League titles, as he always has been, except for that first season, while still getting to the latter rounds of the Champions League, you have to be fighting on all fronts, and that takes some serious resource management. But we know how brilliant he's been at that, and so, you know, he's one of the best at getting the most out of a squad and getting the most out of his players, and he's able to do that on so many fronts. And yeah, we all know that by now.
I think the surprising thing as well is, and this may be just a complete misreading of the situation in my head, but it's like the fact that the 6 semi-finals in a row in the FA Cup, because in my head, Guardiola takes the FA Cup the least serious out of the 4 main trophies. Am I maybe misreading that? Because it does seem that, obviously, I know we've not done great in the old, the three-handle Pellegrini trophy in the past couple of years. But it does seem that the Carabao is what he would prioritise over the FA Cup, at least in his first few seasons, definitely. So the fact that we've had six in a row with the semi-finals in the FA Cup, because it does feel like that is the one that he takes the least serious, because when it gets to this part of the season and you are going for three trophies, I know we did, you know, do the unbelievable last year and managed to do all three, but if he has got to sack one off, he'll sack the FA Cup off.
Yeah.
Which we have seen in semi-finals before. Not that he sacked it off, but just that he sort of put that to one side in favour of the other trophies.
I think that's a totally fair point. It just kind of creeps up on you, though, doesn't it? Like six semi-finals. I don't think I'd really like deep that until it happened at the weekend. And yeah, I get the point that when you get to this stage of the season, sometimes you've got to make more difficult decisions. But I mean, some of those semi-final defeats as well, they've been against good side, like Liverpool won, the Zach Steffen mistakes,
yeah,
comes to mind.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
The ones that, like, you couldn't say he wasn't necessarily going all out for it. It just didn't really happen, or just ran into
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like I say, it's not like he sacked them off, but he definitely didn't put 100% into it.
Yeah.
I mean, getting Sheffield United in the semis last year was quite helpful, wasn't it? I think really in terms of the treble, they could rest a few players, rotate a bit there. Maybe they can do that against Chelsea this time around. We'll see. But yeah, I know what you mean about the Carabao. I think he used to sort of really gun for that one, didn't he, in the first half of the season. Now that's become the fourth priority, really, which is understandable, I guess. But
yeah, we could have done with Coventry this time, couldn't we?
we'll get them in the final. Don't worry about it.
Sky blue final.
So that win over Newcastle in the quarterfinals, it was a walk in the park, as I said in the intro, Mark. It wasn't a game where City really had to get out of second gear, I didn't feel like. How good was the performance overall, do you think?
Yeah, I felt good. Look, I think, I saw a bit of reaction to the performance, and it was like, was it one of those where did they ever really put them away? And I think you can always kind of level that accusation at a lot of City performances, but I think sometimes when we talk about City, we're talking about like gilding the lily slightly, you know, like we're looking for perfection all the time. And if you actually, you know, we have these high standards, but if you go 1-0 up after what, 12 minutes versus a Newcastle side that aren't being particularly ambitious, then you actually don't need to be that good. You know, you don't need to get lucky or anything. You just need to hold that advantage, maintain it and see it out. And I think, you know, City are absolute masters of that. So, I thought it was good that it was a relatively low intensity game, especially in this period where, you know, what's coming up over the horizon with Arsenal, with Real Madrid, after Liverpool, after Anfield, right? So for that was useful. I think people might look back on that performance and compare it to something like, it only takes one mistake for Newcastle to get back into the game, for it to be 2-1. And for it to be a little bit more nervy towards the end. But I honestly didn't really feel like that was a danger at any point. I don't know what you guys felt, but it felt like they saw it out.
Same, really, yeah. I think if that chance of Isak's isn't saved, then maybe it's a more interesting game, isn't it? But apart from that, there was not a lot to worry about.
Well, it was more pre-game. I had a bit of that twingy feeling because I don't know why, but I thought back to, do you remember a few years ago when in the League Cup where we played Newcastle at home and Rolando Aarons tore us a new arsehole?
Oh, yeah.
You know when you just get that niggly feeling at the back of your mind before the game? Because I was with one of my United mates before the game, and he texted me and he texted me during the game and said, after I left him, and said, oh, I've put a bet on Newcastle to win 10-1 because you convinced me that he was a bit nervy. And then he called me every name under the sun saying you're the best team in the world. He obviously just wanted me to lose me money. Because he wasn't nervy at all during the game, was it?
No. Rolando Aarons plays in Slovenia now. I've just Googled him. That's
does he?
All right, past, yeah.
he looked like a world beater that day against
He
us.
Did, yeah, yeah. So City won the game on Saturday with a couple of deflected goals, KC. Are they? Do you put that down to a bit of luck, or is that just kind of making your own luck?
Well, yeah, there is a bit of luck, but it's the case of, I don't think Newcastle really turned up, and I think it's the case, even if we didn't get those deflective goals, we had more than enough in the tank to to score more if we needed to. But like Mark alluded to, once you get your nose in front and you're against a team that isn't quite at the races, like say the Newcastle of last season, then you can just we are the masters of just easily seeing it out.
Yeah, it was quite comfortable. I was surprised by that mark, really, because I sort of saw the draw and thought, oh, Newcastle, that'll be a tough test. We don't spend a lot of time analysing opposition performances on the Blooming Podcast usually, but as a neutral here, what did you make of their performance? Were you surprised how sort of timid they were?
No, I wasn't actually, because no, look, while accepting the point completely that on paper Newcastle, it looks like a difficult game and a run of difficult games. But did either of you see the performance they put in at Arsenal a couple of weeks ago? Like the first
yeah,
half?
True, actually, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Like. They're so, I don't know what it is. It's the intensity that you would associate with them, certainly last season, beginning of this season a bit as well, it really isn't there. And I know they've had injuries, and I can't believe how important Joe Linton is to them, apparently.
Yeah.
They're all like, we can't do anything, we've not got Joe Linton. I thought this guy was a £40 million flop 3 years. I know that was very much like 3 years ago. He's had a bit of a renaissance since. But it does feel like they themselves they're not as you know, stiff in opposition as they would be to anybody. Like even 3 or 4 months ago, like I think their defensive record since Christmas is one of the worst in the league. And look, if as long as you bring a level of intensity, I think you saw from that Arsenal game that they played a few weeks ago, if you bring a level of intensity towards them, they can't cope with it. And like City were really, I thought in the first like 15 minutes of that game, just really patient in how they were looking to pull them apart, how to get ahead. And then once it came, look, like we're saying, I don't think you were never in doubt. There was never really any jeopardy that they were going to pull themselves back in. They had the Isak chance. I thought they picked up a little bit very briefly in the second half. But even then, like City just know that, oh, if you're going to like try and come back into the game, we'll just snuff it out. You know, they have that ability to do that. And I thought, do you see that video that was going around on like Twitter and stuff afterwards? And it was like Pep talking to Eddie Howe, and he was like, everybody was captioning it like as though they were lip reading Pep, and he was saying, is that how you usually play, or do you usually play like that? And I must have watched this video like 5 or 6 times, more than like the Zapruder footage, scrolling it back and forth to try and figure out if that's what he actually said. But whether he said that or not, I think that's a fair like summing up of Newcastle's performance. It just wasn't up to the usual standard.
Yeah, I think they have been a bit lackluster, like you say. But I think you're viewing Newcastle, well, like I think a lot of us are guilty of viewing Newcastle through the eyes of how surprisingly good they were last season. I think when you think back to where City were at this stage of the cycle after their takeover, we were absolutely crap under Hughes at this point, weren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So I think, you know, I think they overperformed everyone's expectations last year, you know, the League Cup final notwithstanding, which was also lackluster. So I think there was bound to be a dip coming at some point. But I think that, obviously, I don't want to spend too much time talking about Newcastle on a City pod, but I think they'll come back better next season.
Yeah. I agree, yeah. Let's talk about some individuals on the City side of things now. Mateo Kovacic, KC. A lot of people I've seen, and I'm inclined to agree with them, saying that was his best performance in the City shirt at the weekend. Would you agree with that?
I think he should be playing more now. Because obviously he started really well, didn't he? And then, you know, he played like his hair was on fire against Arsenal, didn't he? He was absolutely off his rocker against
Arsenal.
But his
hair wasn't on fire.
But yeah, his head seemed to go to pot a bit then for a couple of months, didn't it? But it's like, as soon as he came on against Liverpool, I thought we got a bit of control back of the game that was running away from us. So I definitely would be playing him as much as possible now until the end of the season.
Does he start against Arsenal for you?
Yes, definitely. Although obviously he might play like his hair's on fire again. but yeah, I would definitely, because I think what he was brought in for was to try and give more control to the game, more control to midfields. Obviously, he's not a direct replacement for Gundogan because Gundogan's a lot more patient, you know, more intelligent with his runs and things like that. And Kovacic isn't that sort of tippy tappy possession player. But he can help control the midfield a lot more,
which I think certainly against Liverpool, we definitely lost that, didn't we? We just didn't have control of the midfield at any point. And I thought that that game was crying out for him to come on at half-time. I know Pep doesn't like to make early substitutions generally. But I think, yeah, in big games from now on until the end of the season, I think you have to play him.
Yeah. What does he bring to City that's perhaps been lacking lately, do you think, Mark?
I think everything Casey just said there, like the control element is paramount, and we talk about it so much in terms of Guardiola and what he wants from his players. Hasn't always been apparent that he's wanted it at all times this season, given some of the selections. But I think Kovacic is that player, right? And I think just that pair with Rodri that you saw, I don't think they necessarily needed a lot of security and a lot of balance in midfield for this game in particular, given everything we've said about Newcastle. But what it offers you there is just that foundation to play off, and just more security than we've seen at different points this season, particularly at Anfield, I think, until he came on. So I don't want to get ahead of myself, but there's sometimes, especially when everyone's talking about these runs City go on, everyone's expecting this run and whatever, that's usually like sparked by a little change. And I just wonder whether Kovacic perhaps coming back into the side and having a bit more of a regular role is a little shift that just, especially in the bigger games, especially Arsenal, especially Real Madrid, whether that helps to inspire just a bit more confidence going into the running than perhaps some people have, or you know, I know a lot of people are already getting excited as well about what's possible. But I just think City look like a better team with him in it, and more like themselves with him in it. So
I think the other thing that he could potentially do as well, and hopefully this will come true as well, because I think De Bruyne's legs aren't what they were. Like, he definitely doesn't, you know, especially coming back from injury. If Kovacic can do more of the running for him, then it'll free him up for the big moments, hopefully.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. And Stefan Ortega, KC, another solid performance from him, made a good save, as I mentioned earlier. He's got this little run in the team coming now with Ederson out injured. Do you think, though, he has any chance of usurping Ederson from that number one spot? What would he have to do in the next few weeks to do that?
I think potentially, yeah. I think if he plays well for the next few games and doesn't make any mistakes, then I think it'd be completely unfair to drop him, really.
Yeah.
He's a better goalkeeper. He's not as good with his feet, but compared to, you know, the majority of goalkeepers around the world, he's much better with his feet than they are.
Yeah.
So I don't have any concerns with him at all when he plays. Like, there's never really been a moment where he's particularly worried me. I'm sure you'll probably remind me of some major fuck up that's not.
I can't think of a single one, really. He got lobbed at Southampton last season, didn't he? That's like basically the only foot wrong I can think of him putting.
Yeah,
City.
but yeah, he just. I don't have any qualms with him in there at all. And I'd be happy if he, you know, if he played to the end of the season. Not that, you know, Ederson at Anfield is just, it's like a completely different person's playing, isn't it? And I don't really want that absolute head loss to sort of mar my vision in terms of how I viewed him, because I think overall he has had a good season, and he was excellent in the Champions League final, wasn't he, last year?
Yeah.
So, you know, Ederson is undoubtedly the number one, but I think if Ortega's in form and playing well, I don't think he should just be dropped when Ederson comes back from injury.
Yeah. What's your prediction with Ortega's contract situation, Mark? Do you think he'll sign on? I mean, the talk is that he's asking for a new one. He's asking for perhaps a bit more money than you would normally pay for a number two. But, you know, the question is he too good to be sitting on City's bench as well, I guess?
Look, I think when he arrived, he knew he was going to be number two, right? And I don't think he's under any illusions that if he stayed, he'd probably... Look, he's always performed well, right? He's always come in and he's always done himself, you know, no harm in that respect. But I think he'd expect that he's going to be number two. So really it's about how much is that number two worth to you? You know, how much do you pay a goalkeeper that really isn't going to have much of an impact on the team in the season until you really need him? And, you know, the fact that City are able to rely on him right now rather than... I don't want to disparage anybody, but I don't know, Claudio Bravo or you know, or Zach Steffen or anybody else that, like,
Scott Carson.
Scott Carson never put a foot wrong in that like 5 minutes that he had. Or the Newcastle game. Yeah. I think that's the question, right? And I don't think he's looking for necessarily more game time. I think he's just looking to be valued more. And it's kind of similar to Gundogan's situation. I know my colleague Sam Lee's done a bit of reporting around this, but it's about what do City value a player of kind of Ortega's status, if you like. And I think that's a question. If I had to predict, I'd predict he'd probably end up leaving, but I don't like to make predictions, so I don't know why I just have.
I wouldn't blame him if he did, put it that way.
I wouldn't blame him if he did, but I would hope he would stay because I think he's been excellent for us.
Yes, he certainly has, yeah. And I found Jeremy Doku's performance in this game a bit interesting, Mark, as well. He seems to be operating a bit more centrally and seems to do a bit more damage in the first half, at least, than he has done recently. Could that be maybe a short-term solution to bring in a bit more out of him?
Yeah, look, I thought it was interesting as well. Like, we've seen Foden, like, dip into that central role a little bit and look, he's playing brilliantly, Foden, but having a bit more impact on games. And I think the same can be true of Doku as well. It's just, like, I'm sure everybody else, the thing we're always talking about with Doku is end product, isn't it? And I guess there was no, you weren't charting up a goal or assist for him again on Saturday. And so that's another game in the bank without one of those. But I think there was that, just little moments. He had that little early burst through the middle, I think, and he just held onto the ball a little too long without releasing it. And it's like, it's just the decision-making in those moments that he just needs to improve on. You know, I think a lot of the excitement that was around him at the very start of the season about how defenders seem scared of him has maybe ebbed away a little bit. But I think we can all see that there's promise there, right? And first season syndrome, all that stuff that we normally talk about with Guardiola. Yeah, look, if this is a different little opening into the team for him, then maybe it's something that he can make use of between now and the end of the season.
Yeah. And Erling Haaland, KC, I mean, he's got 10 goals in 12 games since he came back from injury, but five of those did come against Luton. I mean, this is perhaps a daft question, but is his form a slight concern for you at the moment?
I get where you're coming from asking that question, because he's not hitting the high start, the heights of last season, has he? But I think we also need to remember he hasn't been fully fit as much this year. And I don't think... I think what we also need to take into account is the fact that, like, a lot of the players behind him have changed compared to last season as well. So getting used to, like, for example, we've said, like, Doku, Kovacic, Nunez to a much lesser extent. You know, getting used to new players when you've not been as fully fit. And he's had to change sort of the way that Alvarez has been playing behind him this season as well. You know, those are all different things that I suppose he's had to adapt to as well. And he is still scoring. So I can see, why it is a slight concern, because, let's face it, he isn't as good as last season, which is no slight on him because of just how superb last season was. But I think he'll come good sooner rather than later.
Yeah. I've seen some comments about his body language in the past couple of weeks, Mark. You know, he can be a bit grumpy when he's not playing well. Is that a concern at all, or is that just kind of the mark of a man who wants to get back into form as quickly as possible?
Yeah, look, I think you'd rather that he was a bit pissed off with his own form rather than not be, right? And like, even when he was, you know, last season, you know, I think there was moments where he was looking a bit, just, you know, I don't know, if he misses a chance, he kind of beats himself up a little bit about it, doesn't he? And I think that's what you'd expect and what you'd hope for. So I don't think,
especially when it's an open net, yeah.
Yeah. Like, look, to be fair to him, there haven't been a lot of those. And yeah, like, fair enough. I think you question Erling Haaland at your peril, right? Sure. Yeah. Like, he's going to be fine. I think we all expect it'll be fine. I think all the mitigation about the injury this season is totally fair enough. And even if he's not operating at the level that he set last season, it's still a pretty spectacular level. So I wouldn't be necessarily concerned.
Do you use a VPN? VPNs can keep you protected when working in public by hiding your IP address, and they allow you to use public Wi-Fi hotspots safely. You can use the internet freely in places that restrict content and censor access, and you can share files safely because your connection is encrypted. It's not just about browsing safely either. With a VPN, you can access content from home while you're abroad. Don't let those paid subscriptions go to waste while you're overseas. So if you're going to miss one of City's games because you're not in the country, you can easily stream it with a VPN. If that sounds appealing, then why not try NordVPN? It's easy to use. You can connect in one click, or you can turn on auto connection to do it automatically. There are more than 6,000 servers in 61 countries to join, so you can find one near you for better speed, or you can connect elsewhere to browse freely. You can also get NordVPN on every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, and Linux. Even your Android TV supports NordVPN if you want to use it on that. One NordVPN account protects up to 6 devices too, so you've no need for separate subscriptions. If you want to try it, you can do it and help the Blue Moon podcast at the same time. Sign up at nordvpn.com/bluemoon and you'll get 4 months extra free. You'll also have the Nord 30-day money-back guarantee, meaning you can try it, and if you're not satisfied in the first 30 days, you can get your money back. Head over to nordvpn.com/bluemoon for more details and to sign up for 4 extra months free. We've put the link in the episode description too. nordvpn.com/bluemoon.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
Well, we've had a couple of cup draws since the last podcast recording. We've got Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final. KC, you happy with that, or would you have preferred to maybe draw United in the semi-final and avoid another final against them? Can you be arsed putting yourself through that again?
Well, I would have preferred United because it would have been nicer to get one of the weaker teams, wouldn't it? In the draw. In all seriousness, no, it's like Chelsea seem to have our number, even when Chelsea are absolutely crap. You know, they've played really well against us like twice this season, and then even going back under Tuchel, you know, I don't know why, but they seem to really, really up the game when they're playing against us. So that is a bit of a concern, you know, especially I probably should have looked this up before we started, but I don't know what games we've got around the Chelsea FA Cup semi-final. So if it does come back to a case of Pep not giving, you know, the 100% that we were talking about before when it comes to semi-finals, then that might be a concern. But we still should have enough to beat them, surely to God.
Well, you'd hope
it's
so.
It's going to be after it's going to be after the Madrid second leg. So
What I mean. So players may well be rested for that semi-final, so you never know what could happen.
Yeah, maybe the Cole Palmer factor as well.
I know. Yeah.
And speaking of Real Madrid, it's them again in the Champions League, Mark, in the quarterfinal this time, and it's becoming quite a rivalry, that one. Are you expecting it to be more like last year when City battered them in the second leg, or perhaps more like the year before when it all went tits up in the second leg?
It is becoming like weirdly like regular, this fixture. I saw Mooney tweet that Real Madrid are like the Shakhtar Donetsk of the knockout stage. I wish I'd tweeted that. That's a great. I never even clocked this until now. It is. And I instinctively, quite pessimistic, I would expect it to be more like the game 2 years ago, because I just think that we keep coming back to it, the C word, control, right? It's just not at the same level this season quite. You know, look, for all the reasons that we just mentioned, I think you want Kovacic playing in that game. Ideally, you'd want Grealish playing in that game. I think you'd want basically a retread of last year as much as possible, to just try and, you know, because both those performances, I think, were two of the best City performances under Pep, I think it's fair enough to say, in different elements. And so you'd look for a repeat of that, but I just don't think we've seen that same level of, real control on a consistent basis this season, to be confident that particularly the away leg will be, you know, a positive result. I don't know.
Could you see him revert to putting Bernardo out on the wing, do you reckon, then?
I think he's done that quite a lot in big games, hasn't he? And it's typically worked. And like back end of last season, it was, you know, that was part of the formula. So I'm trying to let all the dominoes fall in my head to figure out exactly the repercussions that we'll have on the rest of the team. And it's not always wise, is it, to do that with Guardiola? So, But yeah, like that's one thing you could look to do. I just, you just don't have this. I don't have the same confidence going into. Not to mean that they can't get through the tie over. I just think that certainly the Bernabeu leg is going to be a bit more. Is going to be a bit more difficult.
Yeah, definitely. Quick one for you both. Can / will City do the treble again, KC?
It's just a horrible question, that, Dan. You know what it is? I'm really tempted to throw it back at you. But yeah, you've got, like Mark just said, we're not quite as good as we are last year. But having said that, I don't think there's anyone better than us in any of the competitions. Mm. So you have to say yes. But we know trebles are very rarely done, so you have to be cautious. My heart says yes, we will do it, but you know, looking at it in terms of how we're playing and you know the history of how difficult a treble is, we are more than likely going to slip up in one of them, aren't we?
I mean, for me, Mark, the least likely trophy that I think they'll win this season is the Premier League title.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I think I don't think I'm going to win it.
Show you're working.
I agree with you, Dan. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. I think the Champions League is the least likely, only because of the kind of nature of it. Like, you're at the quarter, you've got five games to negotiate. You're on the tough side of the draw now. And it's knockout football, right? And I think we've seen, you know, other than last season, exactly the ways it can go against City. So I think Champions League of the three would be the most difficult one. I appreciate that the Premier League title race looks incredible at the minute, like from a neutral perspective here.
The thing is with the tough side of the draw in the Champions League, obviously I know we came through probably the toughest draw last year with, you know, beating Bayern then Real, you know, to get to the final. But I think the tough side of the Champions League draw is actually more helpful in a way, potentially, because when it comes to a one-off game, any team's heads can just completely go. But I think you've got the opportunity in the Champions League, even against the big teams, because we are better than, you know, everyone left in it. So you have got two legs to right, you know, any potential head loss in the first leg. So yeah, that's why I would be more confident about the Champions League, weirdly. Obviously, these are famous last words, and we'll probably bowl with every competition from here on in. But that's just that's my workings for why I would be more confident getting the tough teams in the, you know, the tougher half of the draw.
Well, see, I think so. Like, I agree with all of that, but my logic is kind of reversed for the league. So it's like you've got 10 games left in the league, and City are the best team, and so
fair.
Do you know what I mean? But I think you can look at it either way. And like, I think it's a really good point that City are easily the best. Well, not easily, but I think most people would agree are the best team in all three of these competitions. But actually maintaining that level over three competitions in the different formats is really difficult. And that's why last season was such a huge achievement.
You can tell who the City fans and who the non-City fan is on this podcast, can't you?
Maybe, yeah.
Well, the new season ticket prices were announced on Wednesday, with many supporters reporting that the price of theirs had increased again ahead of next season. We did approach the club for comment on how this can be justified while the country is experiencing a cost of living crisis, how accessible the lower price tickets will be for fans who want to switch their seat, what relevance the season ticket prices at other clubs have to City fans, and whether the club sought feedback from supporters regarding the continual price rises over the last 10 years. Unfortunately, the club chose not to address these points at this time, so we'll talk about it amongst ourselves. KC, I assume yours has gone up again?
Yeah, mine's gone up again, like it always does. You know, I think City time these announcements knowing that I'm coming on the podcast every year. Because, like, obviously, I've been Mooney penciled me down about 2 weeks ago to come on this one. And it's like a message you, Dan, and Mooney and a few others. And I was like, for fuck's sake, it's like they planned it. Like, you know, because obviously, I have got a reputation for just moaning constantly every season about the price rises. I think this year feels a little bit different because, and I think what a lot of people haven't taken into account is, I think they want to reduce, they're actively trying to reduce the number of season ticket holders with the price rises. So the fact that the silver, the silver season ticket, was it, where you could go to 14 games aside from the top six games, that's been removed and they've replaced it with the gold flexi season ticket. So in the, which on the face of it, when you look at it, you know, and you say £150 a year, but you only have to buy 10, you know, a minimum of 10 tickets for the year to, you know, to carry on that flexi card, you know, for the next year. But in the small print of that, it says that you can't get a season ticket back after that. So that would act. Right. So anyone that goes for a gold flexi ticket would not be eligible for a proper season ticket in future seasons. There haven't been any new season tickets released to fans for, I think, is it something like 4 or 5 years now? Any stadium expansions, I've been led to believe that none of those seats of any potential expansions, none of those tickets will go to season ticket holders. And at the moment, 75% of our match day attendances are from season ticket holders, which is the second highest in the league. I think only Everton are ahead of us. So when you compare that to, say, Liverpool, who've got less than, I think it's something like 40-odd% of their match day attendance is done by season ticket holders. The reasoning behind that, so if you view this purely as a price rise thing from a revenue stream, so obviously I think it's something daft like 0.015% of our revenue is going to increase by these increases. But when you view it as the fact that if they're actively trying to reduce the number of regular match day fans in favour of people that come in, you know, for one-off games and things like that, that the revenue that those fans bring to games is considerably higher, because they'll go to the shop, you know, they'll hang around the ground a lot more, they'll spend a lot more in the ground than your average fan will. So that is the way that the club is viewing it. And they will also be opening up to, you know, a lot more hospitality and things like that. And I think that is the major concern at the moment with me. And I've seen quite a lot of commentary. I've tried to avoid as much as I can, but I've seen quite a lot of commentary from fans from abroad saying, oh, it's not that much and et cetera, and saying that, you know, local fans and season ticket holders don't want people coming from abroad. That is not the case at all. You know, I gladly have anyone coming in from here, there and everywhere. But what you also have to remember is a football club is traditionally the heart of a community as well. And City are trying to move further and further away from being part of the community. And that's what it feels like. We're trying to get away from our roots. And I think that's what a lot of local fans are feeling. I think we should have a balance where we can have people that can come in from anywhere and see it as, a tourism spectacle and things like that. However, it shouldn't be at the expense of people that basically put away a massive percentage of their yearly income. The club have said, you know, I think people from the club have said, you know, it's less than an inflationary, you know, less than inflationary pay rise. But when the club is earning that much money, and people, if you're viewing inflation in terms of like a global economy, you're not viewing it in terms of what are people's actual real term pay rises. The vast majority of people haven't had inflationary pay rises over the past 10, 15 years, yet the club have consistently put up prices over that time. And I think it's just trying to price out as many people as possible. And, you know, the atmosphere will get worse because of it. And there's no two ways about it. I'm a bit sort of, like I say, I know I'm a moaning git and I've gone on a big long monologue here, but it's just, I'm fed up. I don't get the people that constantly, like the club could do anything and people would just defend them. And it's just like, I don't understand fans that blindly defend the club in every situation, because surely you want your football club to be better. We should be wanting City to be the best football club it could possibly be. And taking advantage of the fans isn't part of that. So I just don't get people that blindly defend them at every single turn, regardless of anything.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think you're spot on there about why the club is doing this. From the outside, Mark, can you understand the logic behind it at all, why the club keep doing this amid record revenues, you know, just really pissing off the hardcore fans that have been going for years? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
No, I think Casey spoke brilliant about it there. And look... I don't want to play devil's advocate. I'm when I like when the accounts come out every year and you sit down and go through them, I'm often left with that job because I've somehow got a reputation for this. It's very worrying.
Oh God, that sounds fun.
A reputation for this. I have no idea what I'm doing. But when you go through it and you look at cities particularly, match day revenue is lower than the other main revenue streams. It's lower than, I think it was only, it's traditionally been lower than the other, if you like, big six clubs in the Premier League. I think it overtook Chelsea last year, I think, but I'd have to double check that. But it's traditionally been something that you'd look at and you think, you know, when I see that, my heart kind of sinks a little bit, because not because I'm like, oh, City aren't making as much money as I hoped or whatever. It's because you know where they're going to try and find that extra cash, right? And it's going to go through the fans. And I think it's just so predictable. And, you know, look, it's been, predictable is the word, not inevitable. You know, it's happened time and time again for year after year after year now. It doesn't have to be that way. The club doesn't have to do this. Everyone's points about the profits and that, they, you know, this isn't necessary. And I feel like there needs to be a realization that this is going to be felt in the end, in the stands, in the atmosphere, in the experience that ordinary, yes, local, but also, you know, fans from elsewhere who perhaps can't afford these prices, they're not going to be able to go. The match day experience is going to be poorer for it. And yes, it might make the balance sheet look a bit healthier. Maybe it's the most obvious thing that you pick out from that balance sheet to improve upon. But passing that cost off onto the fans in the middle of a cost of living crisis, in the middle of, you know, we're never going to stop the kind of rapacious capitalism of Premier League football and elite football, but we should at least try to. And I think, you know, it's another really poor like PR move from the club, if nothing else.
Just like, you know, a price freeze would be such a small gesture that would mean so much to people, wouldn't it, at this point? It just, I just find it really disgusting, to be honest with you. But we're going to talk in even more depth about the price rises on next week's show, and we'd like to know what you, the listeners, think about it. So please get in touch. You can tweet us at Blue Moon Podcast or email us through the website bluemoonpodcast.com. Now, the former City chairman, David Bernstein, has a new book out looking at his life growing up as a fan of the club and how he ended up becoming a key figure on the board in the 1990s. He's been speaking to David Mooney, who started by asking about some of his earliest memories of being a City fan.
We lost the cup final in 1955 to Newcastle, where we played most of the game with 10 men. And we, you know, to my absolute joy, we got back into the final again the following year against Birmingham. And it happened. It was on May the 5th, 1956, a scorching hot day. I remember it so clearly. And it was my bar mitzvah day. And that day was meant to be very much put aside for religious things and so on, but I wasn't going to have it. And even in the synagogue, the actual rabbi made a few jokes about my love for City. And I watched the match in the afternoon, and it was a glorious win, a really great display. Only marred by, of course, Bert Trautmann, the goalkeeper, breaking his neck, but carrying on and playing the last 15 minutes with a broken neck. So that was a really memorable day. And I suppose it made me feel almost like my support for City was fate. You know, they'd only won the cup. I think that was the fourth time in their history. And to be on that specific day, you know, really, I thought was quite extraordinary for me.
Yeah, well, let's kind of get into that. How did you end up kind of becoming a kind of, in quotes, more than a fan? Because you think back to kind of where City were in the kind of late 80s, early 90s. Like, how did that end up with you becoming on the board and becoming chairman?
So as the years went by and City started to sort of go downhill somewhat, I began to think maybe in some way I can help. And in fact, I tried to contact Peter Swales when he was chairman, and I did meet with him very briefly at Arsenal. When City were playing there, but it was a very short and meeting came to absolutely nothing. And then a few years later, I was involved in some business situation with a guy who knew Mike Summerby and knew I was a very keen City fan. And it was around about the time of Fanny Lee's takeover of the club, or taking a large stake and becoming chair. And he said, would you like to meet Fanny? And I, of course, to meet Fanny Lee, and it was just heaven for me. And I met with him. I gave him quite a bit of financial advice, which he frankly didn't take. He went on then and did what he did, and found very soon, very quickly, he was getting short of funds. He was undercapitalized. what he was trying to do. And we'd kept in touch, and he invited me to come onto the board, which, you know, you can imagine, what a privilege and how exciting that was. But I came onto a board and found pretty soon that the club was still in a desperate sort of state. And over the 4 years I worked with Franny, we worked very closely together. In fact, things in general went from bad to worse, particularly on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the financial state. A lot of fans will talk about how City had financial problems in the 90s and kind of it led to where City ended up in the late 90s. How bad was it?
It was really bad. I mean, the club was not performing on the pitch. We would, 1 year, we had five managers or acting managers in 1 year. The Main Road Stadium was in need of, a great stadium, but was in need of repair and upgrading. We didn't have a training ground to speak of, which is, you know, unheard of for a serious sports organisation. We didn't have a store to sell our goods in. It was a tiny, tiny thing. It wasn't a store at all. Our offices were in a house in Moss Side. I mean, totally inappropriate for, and the actual general management of the club, frankly, wasn't great. And there was no money. So if you take all the things together, and on top of all that, the fans were getting extremely agitated, quite understandably, about the way things were going, and the situation was turning quite ugly.
Yeah, was there a point anywhere in that kind of time when you got there and you realised that things were actually spiralling out of control?
Well, I suppose it wasn't a particular. Well, maybe if there was a moment. It was at a stage when we'd lost a particular game, and I can't remember which one it was. And David Makin, who was turned out to be a very important supporter for the club, he went on local radio live and said Franny had to go. And I think that sort of really began to bring things to a climax and to a head. And I think the pressures on Franny really grew, and in the end, the shareholders and the rest of the board came to me and said, would I be prepared to take over? Which was, I have to say, in one way, of course, it was an easy decision, but it was a very difficult decision as well, because I'd worked very closely with Franny. I had great respect for him and time for him. And it was a really hard thing to do to, in the end, tell him that we had to make this change.
Yeah, is it difficult to kind of come in when there's lots of kind of different factions and different kind of divisions in the boardroom? Is it difficult to come in and kind of unite people to pull in the same direction?
Well, this is a key part of the book, David. The book is about a number of things, but it's about change and how to change a failed or failing organisation. And because things were so bad, and we were just on the verge of going down to the third level of English football, people were very nervous, very scared. They were scared of the fans. They were scared of the whole situation. And it gave me an opportunity to really do things the way that I wanted to do them, to bring in a stronger management team, and to really deal with a whole range of issues that needed handling. Some of them were real and really important things. Other things were symbolic, if you like. But they were to show everybody, our bankers, but above all our supporters, that we meant business. This was for real. It wasn't some cosmetic playing around. It was a serious attempt to really upgrade the club.
Yeah, what do you remember then of kind of the early period after you became chairman? Because you became chairman with a few games of that 97-98 season to go, and there was a chance City could still stay up, but it was going to be difficult.
Yes, that went by very quickly. There was only a few games left. We went down to the last game. We won 5-2 at Stoke, played extremely well, but the other results went against us. And at the time, it seemed pretty devastating, but I began to think pretty quickly this was actually an opportunity. In a way, the level of that failure gave us a unique opportunity to make these changes. The supporters, the fans. Well, I did a plan for recovery, a two-page spread of the Manchester Evening News the day after we went down. And I think that gave many of the fans a bit of hope that there was something sort of serious and structured taking place here. And we got on with the job, and in a way, that season, that first season with Joe Royle, in the third level was a fantastic. In a way, it was a fantastic season. I mean, the first part of it was really difficult. We didn't do that well on the pitch, and at Christmas we were the bottom half of the table, unbelievably. But we beat Stoke City over the Christmas period in a really crucial game, and from then on, we started a sort of a momentum and a rise, which, well, we've hardly stepped back since then. So that was a crucial period.
Yeah, I was going to ask about kind of those key games, because you mentioned kind of QPR and Stoke in the relegation. Obviously, there was the turnaround against Stoke. Do you remember the feeling after York?
I remember the feeling after York and after Lincoln and after losing to Wycombe Wanderers twice in the league, home and away. I remember all those things vividly. I mean, it really was, you know, to go to, with all due respect, to smaller clubs than we were and get beaten was really, really unpleasant, dispiriting. But as I say, that started to change, and momentum is so important in life as well, but in sport for sure. And we began to develop that momentum, which took us a long way.
Yeah. At what point then after the... it may have been before the relegation, after the relegation, but there was an offer, a rather strange offer from Wimbledon, wasn't there?
Well, it was very strange. I have to say, we dismissed it pretty out of hand. But it was a sort of an attempt at, like we might call, a reverse takeover. In other words, they had then managed, you know, to stay in the Premier League, in the top division. We had everything else. We had, you know, we had the supporters, we had the history. We were Manchester City, and I think they felt that they could leverage their Premier League status and sort of combine, merge with us to get for them the best of both worlds. As far as I was concerned, it was completely unacceptable. There's no way we'd do something like that. But it shows, when you're in a weak position, how if you don't handle things very carefully, you can end up in a very compromising sort of situation. Because our fans would have been, and quite rightly, livid had we even thought about something like that.
Yeah, and then obviously the season goes as it goes, and City have a very good second half to the season, end up finishing third. There's various points in the playoffs where I'm kind of keen to get your memories, because I'm interested how you felt kind of like 15, 20 seconds into the first leg against Wigan, as soon as everything looked to be going to pot again.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Yes. The ball ends up between two of our players, and a Wigan player pops between them and knocks it into the goal. I was sitting next to Joe Royal. I apparently went white. And Joe turned to me, he had a packet of sweets, and he said, peppermint, chairman, very calmly. And a bit like, I felt he was about Sir Francis Drake, you know, with the Armada. Very calm. And, we managed to scrape the draw, and then, thank goodness, win that second leg in this sort of tumultuous game at Main Road. I mean, these games were fantastic, really. You know, I mean, okay, there were no divisions, but there was so much at stake, and the crowd was so behind us, the fans were so behind us, and it was tremendous atmosphere we were playing in. And to get through to the final, you know, which we felt beforehand was going to be not easy, nothing's easy, but we felt we were hot favourites to win it. But of course, it would turn out to be much more difficult than that.
Yeah, so then 2-0 against Gillingham, kind of like, what are the thoughts going through your head there? Because, I mean, out of anybody in that stadium, you know the situation behind the scenes. So what were you thinking?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, looking at this giant scoreboard, Gillingham 2, Manchester City 0, with about 2 minutes to go. And I'm thinking, boy, this is going to be difficult. You know, we've got through this first season in that division in pretty good shape, really. But if we don't make it out, and we're going to have a second season there, it's going to be really hard. The fans were getting impatient. People will lose confidence in us. It's, you know, it was, I always felt pretty down. And then, of course, we get the first goal miraculously, but you think, well, that's not enough. You know, it's too little, too late. And then Paul Dickov's equaliser. Well, that was, for me, that's the most exciting moment I've ever had in sport. And nothing else will ever rival that for me. And I think it's the most important goal ever scored in Manchester City's history. Because had we not, in the end, won that game, then a lot of things may not have happened, including the new stadium may not have happened. And if that doesn't happen, then history is very different for Manchester City.
Think of some dynamic teammates who got it done. City have had some great partnerships down the years, whether it's De Bruyne and Haaland, Dunn and Distan, or Rosler and Walsh. But what about the perfect teammates when it comes to growing your business? That's you and Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're auctioning autographed apparel or selling sleek skis, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bluemoon. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/bluemoon to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/bluemoon.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
What did that promotion mean for the finances? How, I mean, people talk about City going out of business, going into liquidation. How close did that ever come?
No, I don't think we're ever going to be going to liquidation, because we always had the options of cutting costs, of cutting play, you know, of scaling down. But that's the last thing we wanted to do. I mean, we were doing things very responsibly. You know, I felt we needed to combine the passion for the club and the passion to succeed with a very sensible step-by-step basis. So we were building proper foundations for the club. So we weren't going to go bust. But you know, that promotion was very important because it did give us a bit more income. We could get more, you know, from ticket sales, all sorts of things, sponsorships and so on. And also it began to bring some confidence back into the club. People within the club, people outside the club, the City Council, Sport England, with whom we were dealing with, you know, to do the new stadium deal. All those people began to say, yes, these people seem to know what they're doing, and you can see it in our results. So that credibility that was so important began to come back, largely because we were, I think, handling ourselves properly, but we got that promotion as well.
Yeah, and you say had the promotion not happened, the stadium deal might not have happened. Let's talk about the stadium, because the deal to move to the City of Manchester Stadium was very favourably structured for City, wasn't it? It felt like good business at a time when City had spent years not doing good business.
Yes, I think it's been regarded as the deal, or the stadium deal in English football, really, because we were, you know, we played our hand, I think, very sensibly and very well. We didn't have a strong hand to play. Our cards were weak, but on the other hand, we knew we were the only possible long term tenant that was big enough to go into that stadium. So we negotiated with the City Council and with Sport England and others, and very complicated negotiations. But we said from the beginning, this stadium has got to be a blue stadium. It's got to be fit for purpose for our fans. It cannot have an athletics track after. It has to be a purpose-built football stadium. And they came up with a very clever solution, as you'll know, that it was built with part of the stands underground for the Commonwealth Games. And then the day after the games finished, they began to dig up and reveal the bottom part of the stands, converting it into a proper football stadium. In fact, there was a fabulous model made of the stadium before and after the games, from an athletics to football. And within the book, there's a picture of Her Majesty the Queen coming to Manchester and looking at that model, inspecting it. And I was with her then. And she was really impressed. And I actually have to say, very interested, I thought, in what we'd done and how we were doing it.
Yeah, let's turn our attention to back to the pitch, because after that promotion against against Gillingham, the next season City just seemed to kind of harness that momentum and kind of fly through the leagues through Division One. At the start of that season, what was the aims and objectives when you sat down with Joe? What were you talking about? What you wanted to achieve that season?
Oh well, without question, we wanted to achieve what we did achieve. You know, there's no question that we weren't looking to stay in that division for very long, and we wanted back-to-back promotions. We strengthened the squad pretty well, I thought, considering again we were still had very limited funds, but we strengthened the squad. Joe did a great job. I mean, those two seasons were a great triumph for Joe, and he and I worked very closely together. It was a great privilege working with him. I mean, I enjoyed it enormously. And as you say, it went from strength to strength, very different from the previous season, except there was always an except with us, that it came down again to the last game as to whether we'd go up automatically or not. I mean, this time we were guaranteed the playoffs at worst, but of course we wanted to get up automatically. And the game at Blackburn was nearly as dramatic as Gillingham, you know, being a goal down. Blackburn hit the post four times in the first half. And we come out winning 4-1, not 2-1, but 4-1 in the end, in a wonderful, wonderful day, which goes down with me as the second best day I've had in football after the Gillingham day.
That summer then, leading into the Premier League, it seems that it didn't seem to be a particularly easy summer. I mean, you tell the story in the book of Paolo Wanchope signing, and then the kind of the falling out between George Weah and Joe Royal and the staff there. It seems like after kind of 2 years of real kind of good work and everybody pulling in the same direction, it suddenly got very difficult that summer. Do you know why that was?
Well, that's a difficult sort of difficult question. You need to, you know, people need to read the book where I try and explain that. I think that we, having done so well for two seasons in a row, we didn't adjust fast enough and do enough to really adjust to the Premier League. We made one or two good signings, one or two signings that weren't quite so strong. There were a lot of other issues around the football side of the club, scouting. I'm afraid to say drinking, which features in the book. There's quite a lot about a drinking culture, which was very unfortunate. Fitness, sort of fitness side of the club, and so on. There were other areas. And this again is covered in the book. I'd had the privilege of meeting Arsene Wenger and spending 2 hours alone with him at their training ground, when I learned so much about what at that stage was the best setup in football. Really, Arsene had brought a lot of new ideas into this country about training, about eating, about water, about using water for injury recovery, all sorts of things. And I sort of tried to take those back to Manchester. And we did, over the period of time, being a lot on board. But I believe we were too slow in dealing with a range of issues that came together one way or another to give rise to the failure of that season.
Yeah. Was it at the end of that season, after what he'd achieved getting City back into the top flight and then, I mean, ultimately going back down again, was it a hard decision to sack Joe?
Really hard. I mean, as I said to you earlier, you know, we worked together for 2 or 3 years, terrific relationship. I really enjoyed working with him. We'd had two wonderful seasons with those promotions, and right on the edge, but we'd actually got through, you know, both times. So it was very, very sad. And again, the book explains in some detail that at the end I had a really important meeting with him in an Indian restaurant, when I had 13 different issues to discuss with him, and none of them were really accepted. We didn't seem to be able to make progress on any of them. And I decided then that this was not going to work going forward. And we had to do something about it, and which we did. But it was very hard and very sad. And you know, the things you don't like doing, and that was certainly one of them.
Yeah. Obviously, it's football. It's that sort of thing where, you know, you go again. These things happen, and you move on. And it ends up with Kevin Keegan becoming City manager. And there's a lot of fans that certainly that I know that still point to that promotion season as one of their favourites. Even in the context of everything City have achieved in the last few years, you know, with the football Guardiola's been playing. They still go back to that Kevin Keegan promotion season with Berkovic and Benabia and like the exciting football that was being played. When you appointed Kevin Keegan, could you ever have imagined that City would go up in that sort of style?
Yes, definitely. The reason we appointed him was that we wanted someone who could make a real and immediate impact, and Kevin was certainly an impactful manager, and you know, we knew he was demanding. I mean, this is further down the road where problems arose, but at that stage things went very well. He did well in bringing in certain players. He was very inspirational in handling the side, and we ended up with 100 goals and 100 points, and it was a glorious season. No last minute issues in that season. It was fabulous. And among the things he did was, of course, bring in Ali Bernabeu and Al Berkowitz, two very creative players who people said couldn't play with each other, but in fact did play with each other and played some wonderful, attractive attacking football. So, yes, it was a fabulous first season.
Yeah, when you get to the next summer and planning for the Premier League, I mean, the phrase you use in the book is "Chairman, are you sitting down?" What sense did you get from Keegan for planning for the Premier League? Because he seemed to have certainly as a newly promoted team, really big ambitions and big ideas.
Well, indeed, he did. He did, and that sitting down title for one of those chapters is absolutely very real. As I said before, we knew when we brought Kevin in that he was demanding. That it was a bit like taking a tiger by the tail. You know, he's a very, very special sort of one-off person, and that worked well up to a point. That first season, as we said, was terrific. We planned hard for the second season. We would do everything we could to raise funding to give him the sort of support that we wanted, because clearly the last we wanted was to go back down again or make the mistakes that we made the previous time we'd been promoted. So we were very much as one in principle. But as time went by, Kevin's demands, in my eyes, became sort of unrealistic, particularly the issue of Robbie Fowler, which became extremely contentious.
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of behind the scenes kind of that deal had to be restructured, and the way you talk about it in the book is fascinating with how the deal had to be done to actually get it over the line in a way that would be okay for City to do. What effects were those sorts of decisions and those sorts of things having on the boardroom at the time?
Well, I prided myself that over the 3 years or 4 years of my chairmanship, we'd had an incredibly unified, disciplined board. We got our act really together. I said at one or two board meetings, I said, we should be really proud of what we've done. The board is together, the whole club is together, the supporters are right behind us, we're communicating well, you know, we have high, much higher levels of sort of recognition and respect from the media, et cetera, et cetera. But as we got to this stage with Fowler and so on, things began to fragment somewhat. One or two of my colleagues on the board felt we had to support Kevin under virtually any circumstances. I didn't feel that. I'd said we built this club back up based on solid foundations, and I didn't want to jeopardize that. I was very ambitious as well, but I wanted to do things in a, you know, in a structured stage-by-stage way, which had worked very well up to then. Some divisions began to appear. And you know what? You know, in a football club particularly, once that happens, people then do speak to the media. Things get out. There are headlines in the local media. Who's running Man City? You know, is this one doing this or that one doing that? And things can get out of control very, very quickly. You know, it's tough to get things organise and together, it's very easy for them to fall, to break apart. And that's what began to happen.
Yeah. So how difficult was it at that point for you to hand in your resignation to step down? It's like you've overseen City's, you know, return to the top flight and kind of got everybody and turn this crisis club into something, you know, respectable again. And it's, you know, your boyhood club. You've been supporting them for forever. You get to the point where you just feel like I can't do this anymore. I'm not enjoying the. You mentioned not enjoying the train trips up to Manchester. Like how hard is that decision then at that point?
Well, yeah, I think it's one way it was extremely hard, and another way it wasn't. I think it was obviously extremely hard because I loved the club. I'd enjoyed this role more than anything else I've done in business or anything, you know, in my life. It was a lifetime highlight. And the success we'd had sort of added to that. But I realised that, if you like, if I wasn't careful, this was really going to sort of break up. I'd be sort of trying to continue to chair a board and an organisation that was not unified, that wasn't completely behind me as it had been up to then. And I just didn't want that. The job is a hard one. If you're getting it right and you've got your action, your team together, then it's very doable. But if things start to go the wrong way, then it becomes close to mission impossible. And I didn't want to sort of go down that route where things went from bad to worse. So you can imagine it was an incredibly tough decision. But I don't regret it. I think it was the right decision at the right time, unfortunately. And also, unfortunately, I was sort of proved right because the club's finances did deteriorate. They did overspend. They did get themselves back under pressure. And all that led to them getting a rather panicky sale of the club to Taxman Shinawatra, which is something I strongly objected to. I did not think he was a fit and proper person to Manchester City. And, and the result... You know, the losers of that, financially at least, were the shareholders who were largely the fans. Because at that stage, we'd had 2,000 or so shareholder fans or fans who were shareholders. And they basically sold out to Shinawatra at an undervalue. And he made a decent profit when he sold it on to the Abu Dhabi people. So, I think it was a very sad sort of conclusion, which could have gone very, very wrong. I mean, in the end, of course, this story, it's a great story that's emerged from this. But it did go wrong for a while and could have gone very wrong, although because of, this sale, it's ended up, of course, as an amazing success.
Yeah. In terms of your time as chairman, you said you don't regret the decision to resign. Do you have any regrets at all about how things went under your stewardship? Or you look back quite fondly now of the job that you did?
Well, I look forward on the whole thing very fondly indeed, except for the last bit. And if you ask, could I have done things differently at the end? Maybe, but we did. I think once we made the decision to bring Kevin in, and once I think maybe I overestimated the ability to keep the board together and to keep them on side in the way that I had. I think I was a bit perhaps over optimistic about the ability to continue to do that when other strains and stresses started to appear.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
The full interview with David Bernstein is available now for Patreon backers. Head over to patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast to sign up. David Bernstein's book, We Were Really There, The Rebirth of Manchester City, is out now. All of the proceeds from the book are going to the charity Level Playing Field, which is working to create a positive matchday experience for fans with disabilities. Let's finish now with a couple of listener questions. We've got a couple here that we can group together. So Andy Ragg has been in touch on the Patreon, and he says, on last week's show, you discussed City failing to beat teams in the top half. If you look at the other clubs in the so-called Big Six, we have indeed only taken 11 points from 24, and yet Liverpool have taken 8 from 24. Arsenal have done much better, but City, whilst unbeaten since early December, are yet to really hit top gear. I think we will. Arsenal may dip and Liverpool remains the true challenge, despite both their and our form being a bit flaky. And Jordan, the Hawaiian Blue, has been in touch on the emails. Aloha, Jordan. I was thinking it was this international round last year that things started to come together. I was a bit shocked to hear on the last episode that City hasn't beaten anyone higher than sixth this season. Last season, we handed out a lesson to Leipzig and to Burnley right before the break. Do you think there's been signs that a similar winning streak in the final run of matches can happen this season? KC, I mean, that's the thing that I find that a lot of non-City fans just sort of assume is going to happen every year, that City are going to go on this mad winning run and... sweep all before them. Are you expecting that this season, and what do you think about that record against the top six this season?
Yeah, I was actually surprised when I saw that. I've not really thought about it, whereas I think I probably would have noticed that in other seasons, but I think because of the change in personnel, I've just sort of put it down to the change in players and form and stuff like that. But yeah, I suppose it is a concern when you view it like that. We should put a run together. And I think if we'd have held on against Liverpool, I think that would have been an unbelievable catalyst for the rest of the season. And because normally we've already started the run by now, haven't we?
Mm.
And I think maybe we are leaving it to...
I mean, maybe we're in that run at the same time, you could say. We've run beaten since December, so it's not...
Yeah,
I was gonna say, yeah. It feels like it's kind of... Like what are we looking for? You know, I don't know. Does it need to be a big long stretch of wins? But I think it probably does, right? Because that's the standard that's been set. So
yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. It's just, but yeah, how many games have we got left against top six sides? I know we've got Arsenal coming up at home shortly.
Arsenal and Spurs.
So that's what I mean. We've not got many opportunities.
Oh, yeah, true.
I don't know if they count. I guess the top six, they've got to count, right?
Yeah, but Villa have gone through a slight dip, haven't they, at the minute? Spurs are always a worry. Like, whatever sodding hoodoo they've got over us, I don't know. But I think I would expect us to beat Arsenal, and hopefully that would be the catalyst for the rest of the season. If we go unbeaten from now to the end of the season, then we're laughing, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, who knows what the end of the season has in store, Mark? But I'm thinking if we don't end up winning the league this year, we're probably going to look back at sort of the draw with Liverpool in November, the draw with Spurs, the draw with Crystal Palace. Too many draws for me, I think, this season. Mm. That's probably been City's problem.
Yeah, like, you know, the draws, especially when the standard's as high as it has been over the last 5 or 6 years, a draw, it's kind of like a defeat, right? It's like in the film Speed, the bus that couldn't slow down or whatever. So it's, you know, you've got to maintain a certain pace, and if you drop off it whatsoever, then everything blows up. So I think that's been the case that for years now, right? I'd look at this run and identify that after Arsenal, Villa, yeah, you're right. They've dropped off of late. They haven't been great at home. They've took some batterings at home, really. Some pretty bad defeats, like the Tottenham one a few weeks ago. If you can get through that, then it's relatively clear. I just look at that Tottenham game away as it is as well at Tottenham. And the thing about that is, I think it was originally scheduled for the semi-final weekend. So I think unless they try and play it on a Champions League night, which they were always a bit reluctant to do, then it's going to drop into the week before the final weekend, if you like. So it's like the penultimate game of the season in a midweek before everything's decided. That is going to be particularly tricky if it lands there, I think. Just because
it'll be horrible.
Everything, just because there's a very small but an outside chance, very small chance that it could be the Merseyside derby that midweek as well. So can you imagine just the stakes that there will be? Like, it's tough. I get those draws in November and the defeat at Villa as well. I've just realised the Villa game's at City, isn't it? What was I talking about before? You know, they've already lost at Villa. But that Villa defeat, I think that'll be the key period that they look back on. but it's all to play for and everything to be decided. So
that's right. It could be a lot worse. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Sarah Howells has been in touch on the website. She says, now that Guardiola can't meet Klopp again, it's the end of their head-to-heads. It feels like Klopp often get the better of Pep on the field, but Pep won the war by continually winning leagues and trophies. Should I be annoyed that this gets called the Klopp and Guardiola era by neutrals and not just the Guardiola era? Mark, as a neutral, is it Klopp and Guardiola era or just the Guardiola era for you?
I think, look, that if you ask Pep, he would say that Liverpool have defined is the wrong word, but you know, whenever he's asked this question before a Liverpool game, he says, you know, they've pushed us on, they've pushed us forward, and they're the reason why we're so good. And so from that respect, yes, I do think that, like, especially outside, like, if you like neutral or the media or whatever, like to pit two rivals against each other to define eras and define periods, and it's the same with United and Arsenal, right? In the 90s and the 2000s, and Ferguson and Wenger, the balance of trophies is definitely tipped Guardiola's way. There's no way of arguing that, I don't think. So yeah, and you can't really have your cake and eat it and argue that City have been super dominant and nobody can compete with them, and then say that there's been a Klopp and Guardiola era. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, Klopp's done it all in the shoestring, hasn't he? So,
but even the Ferguson Wenger thing, Ferguson completely outdid Wenger in trophies, but it's still the Ferguson Wenger era. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I it doesn't bother me in the slightest, really, you know, that it is the Klopp and Guardiola era, because I think it has been. Even though Pep has outdone him, I think, you know, Liverpool have definitely pushed us. And it's like, Dan, I'm sure you've playing Liverpool over the past few years has been absolutely fucking horrible, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad to see the back of it. Yeah. Telling you.
So yeah, I think you have to define it as that, even from a City point of view. Like, they it's been horrible playing them. And, like, even, you know, the title running where it was it like 98 and 97 points, that one where we won it at Brighton last game of the season, or whatever it was. Like, that whole last 3 months of the season was absolutely horrible. Like, it was horrible. I didn't enjoy a minute of it. And it was just like, you have to say, yeah, it's fair enough. Like, I do think, you know, I suppose, is there an underlying bit of the question, is Klopp bigged up a bit too much? I think maybe so, yeah. You know, in some circles, you know, the way that he's sort of treated as, because, you know, I've seen some people in certain quarters put Klopp as like the second best Premier League manager of all time and things like that, which just seems absolutely ridiculous when he's only won one league. So I think he is overhyped in some quarters, but I think that's on the extreme end of fandom. I think, generally speaking, I think it has been the Pep and Klopp era, really.
Yeah. I think you have to say that the Klopp, you know, as well as pushing City really close, he got three Champions League finals as well, right? And that's part of it. And yeah, just how close some of those title races have been. I think it's absolutely the case that it's a Klopp and Guardiola era. It's just that, you know, you can't argue that Pep's probably had the better of it, just about.
Yeah.
The two.
Well, like I say, I'm glad Klopp's going. Good riddance. And on that note, we'll end this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks to my guests, Kieran Clark.
Cheers, mate.
And Mark Critchley.
Cheers, guys.
There's a clip of this week's Patreon show coming up, so stay tuned for that. David Mooney will be back in the big chair next week to preview the tantalising/terrifying clashes with Arsenal and Aston Villa. So maybe try to enjoy the peaceful international break while you can.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
You can argue the intricacies of these refereeing things all day, and good Lord, I did that day. The Gabriel red card I still don't really know what the first yellow was for, but you know what, you can't make that second tackle when you're on a yellow. It's just a daft thing to do. But it was just, I think that game really cemented, and your listenership will love hearing this, how much I fucking hate Rodri. And he's obviously a brilliant, brilliant player, but he's Teflon. He just gets away with it every single fucking game. And there were so many things that could have been yellows, and he only finally got booked up at the final when he took a shot off.
Took his shirt off.
And that actually made things so much worse in that moment. He finally got his fucking booking. And that was why. It really couldn't have been much worse.
It's not really Rodri's fault, is it? Nor was it Fernandinho's. It's the referee's fault for not booking him. If they want to be more lenient, let him be more lenient. You know, there's places and optimal times on a pitch where you can commit a foul. And I think, you know, our number sixes have sort of mastered that over the years, and Pep's drilled it into him. I can see why it's so frustrating for other teams.
Yeah.
But theoretically, there should be nothing stopping other teams behaving that way as well.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.